Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Good afternoon and welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, in 2012, I don't know if you remember this, when British actor Colin Firth was handing or announcing the Oscar winner as being Meryl Streep, she comes up to the microphone and she said something like, "Oh, I bet you're all sitting out there thinking, not her again." Well, that is the title of the new biography on the making of Meryl Streep, written by New Yorker correspondent Michael Shulman, and we'll hear more about that in just a moment. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we'll hear from returning guest and Pacific Northwest author Peter Brown Hoffmeister. His latest novel is called This Is the Part Where You Laugh, Try Until You Fail, Cry Until You Laugh. And Peter had a rather unusual childhood himself, and he channels some of that into his books. We'll find out just how much has gone into this new novel when he joins us later today. But first, I'm going to bring you the interview I did with Michael Shulman. And Michael and I talked by phone a couple of weeks ago. This is the first time we're bringing it to you today. He is a contributor to The New Yorker and has been since 2006. He's the theater editor of Goings On About Town and has written more than 75 Talk of the Town pieces on subjects including Carrie Fisher, Emma Thompson, and the inventor of the Everything Bagel, as well as writing profiles of the playwright Katori Hall and the musical satirist Tin Minchin. And he's the author of the book Her Again, Becoming Meryl Streep. Here's our conversation right now. So, Michael, let's begin with this. It's a huge undertaking to write someone else's story. What made you want to write a biography, and in particular about Meryl Streep?
Well, I was always a huge admirer of her, of course. I do think she's the great actress of her generation. But what really clicked for me in conceiving the book was that I didn't want to write a big soup-to-nuts biography with a capital B called, you know, Meryl Streep, An American Life, that would take 5 years. I really wanted to tell a story about her, and that story was her origins. So I really focused the book very tightly on her coming of age as an actress in the 1970s. And it's really a book about who she was as a 20-something. Essentially, I wanted to answer the question, who was this person before she was the greatest living actress, you know, queen of Hollywood that we all know now? Was she ever just a kind of young person trying to make her way in the world, trying to figure out what to do with herself? And what were the forces that made her who she is? How did she arrive at this incredible talent, this incredible career?
Yeah. Well, you talk about how she had her first little acting experience in the book, and she's around 6 years old, I think. And she began, I think, probably like many girls do, dressing up. And you talk about how she played the Virgin Mary with her mother's underslip wrapped around her head to look like the Virgin Mary. This was inside of her from a very early age, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I think her skill was really innate. She was really, from very, very, very early on, she had this ability to mimic what she saw and become something else, to study characters and inhabit them. To me, what was so interesting was tracking the story of how she learned to use that skill. In other words, I had a friend who is really into comic books, and he read my book and said, well, it's kind of like a superhero origin myth. You know, what's interesting isn't, you know, the mechanics of how Superman can fly. It's how does he learn to use his powers?
Right, right. And she had a lot of turning points along the way. You actually begin the book with the death of John Cazale, who was the first love of her life. And that was at a pivotal turning point in her career also. Tell us a little bit about that relationship and why it was so important to her.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this this relationship she had with John Cazale was really at the heart of the story and a major reason why I wanted to focus on this part of her life. And not many people know that this was a part of her early adulthood, but John Cazale, if people don't know, is best known as Fredo from the Godfather movies. He was an incredible character actor from that time in the same generation as Pacino and De Niro. And he starred in five movies, all of which were nominated for Best Picture, and yet he was never nominated. He always played the kind of weakling, the sidekick, and he had this knack for not really getting noticed in the same way that his co-stars did, even though he is such a wonderful actor. And he met Meryl in 1976 when they were starring together in Shakespeare in the Park in Measure for Measure, and they just started this passionate love affair. You know, it was a kind of affair between two actors who take their craft so seriously, and it was, you know, what we would call now a showmance, you know, the two stars of the play falling in love with each other.
Right.
But they she moved into his loft in Tribeca before it was really known as Tribeca in downtown New York City. And they dated for 2 years, and it was just a life-changing relationship for her that ended very tragically, because just a year into their relationship, John Cazale was diagnosed with lung cancer, very serious lung cancer, and Meryl threw everything aside to nurse him, to be with him, to try to get him through, because she always believed that he would get better. And they starred in The Deer Hunter together. It was their only movie together. And he actually died before it was even finished. She never saw the final movie, and she was nominated for an Academy Award for it. So
right.
Just a tragic, incredible love story that I thought was worth exploring.
Definitely. And she took that role against her instincts, you say. She took it to be with Cazale, but she didn't really want to play that role. Why didn't she want to play that role?
Yeah, well, so she was really a product of the feminist movement of the 70s. You know, this was the time of Ms. Magazine and Gloria Steinem and consciousness-raising groups, and she had a very strong sense of what she wanted to do. She did not want to play ingenues, you know, girlfriends, the sex symbol, the love interest, a lot of the traps that young actresses fall in Hollywood. And that's kind of how she saw this role in The Deer Hunter, as kind of the token girl in a movie that was really about men. You know, it's a war movie. It's about the Vietnam War. And she's kind of, you know, the demure girl back home who, you know, works in the supermarket and puts bows in her hair. And it just wasn't her thing. It wasn't what she wanted to pursue. But it had a part for John Cazale, and you know, he had just been diagnosed with cancer, and she felt very strongly about being with him, and it was this opportunity to work together.
Right. And so as that comes to an end, I believe it was in post-production, people elsewhere are starting working on Kramer versus Kramer, which was really her first, well, I guess The Deer Hunter was one of her first big role, but the Kramer versus Kramer made her a real household name, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Kramer versus Kramer made her the Meryl Streep. It, you know, she was on the cover of Newsweek, which called her the star of the 80s. She won her first Academy Award for Kramer versus Kramer. She just, it was what made her really, it gave her a place in that pantheon with all the other actors of her generation. People would start, that's when people would speak of her in the same breath as De Niro, Pacino, Dustin Hoffman, all these people.
So, interesting story around the Kramer versus Kramer. first of all, she wasn't even chosen. She wasn't even in the running for the part that she played, which was the wife of Dustin Hoffman's character. She played Joanna. She wasn't even in the running for that. Kate Jackson of Charlie's Angels was. So tell us how this came about, because there were conflicting stories about how she ultimately was chosen for that role. She had one point of view. The filmmakers had a whole other point of view.
Yeah, this was so interesting to me. So her audition for Kramer versus Kramer, she went into this hotel room in New York City, and on the other side of the room were Dustin Hoffman, the star, Robert Benton, the director, and Stanley Jaffe, the producer. And the way Meryl Streep told it afterwards, she said she marched into that room, and she had read the screenplay. She knew about the novel, Kramer versus Kramer, and she told them that, you know, they got it all wrong. They had this character wrong. You know, she was demonized in the book, and she should have her own say. She should have, you know, her own sense of dignity and perspective. And the way she sort of, you know, told this story later, it was as if she sort of marched in and told these three very powerful guys, like, here's what, if you want me, here's what you need to change about the movie. But then when I talked to Robert Benton, the director, he said something completely different, which was that, you know, she was this feeble, you know, quiet, very sort of interior person, and she barely said anything. And that's also what Dustin Hoffman has said. And Dustin knew that she had just come out of this terrible tragedy, losing John Cazale. And he thought that's what would make her so great as Joanna Kramer, that he was a woman on the verge of a nervous breakdown, and meaning Joanna. And Meryl was also in this incredibly fragile state. And so that's how she would be able to tap into the role. So basically, Meryl thought that she got the part because of her strength. Dustin thought she got it because of her weakness. And that was sort of the start of the trouble between them.
Yes, and we'll talk about that in just a second. I want to let listeners know my guest is Michael Shulman. His new book is Her Again, Becoming Meryl Streep. So let's stay on Kramer versus Kramer for a minute, because I was fascinated to hear about Dustin Hoffman's method acting, if you will. He didn't just apply that to himself. He took it a step further. In fact, on the first day of filming, he actually slapped Meryl hard across the face to elicit a specific reaction from her. Talk to us about the conflict between them.
Yeah, well, at root, they're very different kinds of actors. Dustin was a really hardcore method actor. And in method acting, the whole idea is that you draw on your own life experiences, your own pain, your own memories, and kind of project them onto a character. Meryl doesn't do that. You know, she works by empathy, by imagination. She can sort of see characters that are completely different from herself and, you know, travel to them. But what was unusual about Dustin's technique is that he not only wanted to mine his own experiences, but he wanted to use what he knew about his co-stars' lives to make them vulnerable and emotional for the scene. So, the second day of shooting, he slapped her across the cheek right before they went on because she had to be really upset. You know, she's leaving Ted Kramer and telling him that, you know, she's leaving behind their son. She doesn't love him anymore. And then there's this part where she's in an elevator about to leave and weeping. And Dustin started using the name John Cazale to, you know, and talking to her about her boyfriend's death from months earlier. It was really very recent. In an attempt just to wring every ounce of emotion out of her. And I don't know, I think that's sort of a bridge too far. You know, it's not something that she needed. You know, he was this big established movie star at that point, and she was a young, untested actress, at least in films. And, you know, what Dustin Hoffman didn't know was that she was Meryl Streep even then. She could draw on any emotion and you know, act any scene, any role, any emotion at any time. And she doesn't work that way, and she didn't need him to sort of provoke her in that way.
Yeah, and there's one section in the book where they're filming in the courtroom, and he'd been taunting her with John Cazale's death. And the filmmaker, Benton said afterward, even though she kept repeating the performance, she kept doing it, you know, astoundingly well. And she must have had a great deal of satisfaction showing Hoffman that, you know, I didn't need all that to begin with, because I can keep pushing it out.
Yeah, I mean, she can out-act anyone, and she doesn't need, you know, that sort of method acting provocation that he was trying to use on her.
Yeah, you also talk about a one scene where he set up. He set this up with a cameraman ahead of time, but didn't tell Meryl, and he smashed a glass across the room. And she did respond to that, saying, you know, she didn't appreciate it.
Yeah, this was another thing that Dustin did to get an authentic reaction from her, which is to not tell her that he was going to slam this wine glass against the wall and shatter it. I mean, I think what's interesting is that Dustin has bragged about all this stuff over the years. I think he, you know, was never about being cruel to her or anything like that. It was really out of this sincere belief that this would heighten the scene. This would get the best possible performance out of both of them. And I don't know, did she need that? Did she not need that? Would she have been great anyway? You know, between the two of them, something did go right because it's a wonderful movie.
Yes, it was nominated for 9 awards, I believe. And let's talk about her views on feminism, because this movie in particular got a lot of reaction from people. They either loved it or hated it, you know, depending on how they viewed it. A lot of feminists at that time thought that the film was making a hero of a man taking care of a kid when women do it all the time. And originally, I guess the film was made because someone along the way, one of the filmmakers, was fed up of, you know, men being portrayed as the bad guys. But yeah. Go ahead.
Well, actually, it was the author of the novel Kramer versus Kramer, Avery Corman.
That's right.
I spoke to him. And he said that he wrote the book because he was fed up with the toxic rhetoric he was hearing from feminists in the 1970s, who he thought painted all men with a broad brush, and he wanted to defend the good father. So basically, he wrote a story about this woman who leaves her husband and child, and then the man has to learn to do everything a mother would do, and, you know, learns the meaning of fatherhood and the value of, you know, bonding with his son. In the process, though, that character, Joanna Kramer, the woman, was painted as a little bit of a caricature of, you know, the feminist of the 70s, trying to go out and find her, you know, meaning and in her life, self-actualizing and going, you know, going to California to find some sort of vague goal. And she comes across as very cold and narcissistic. Now, Meryl realized that. And so what she brought to the movie was a real kind of empathy and sense of depth to that character, and played her with so much sophistication and texture that you actually, you know, you're caught when you watch the movie. You think maybe, oh, you know, she's not that bad after all. Maybe there is something, you know, maybe she does have this, you know, legitimate grievance with her marriage, and maybe she was totally right to leave and try to become her own person. So she really tried to redeem that character. Even then, I think a lot of people were divided about the final product, because it was right in the DNA of the movie that this was a kind of backlash to feminism.
Yes. Now, she has said that Meryl's views on feminism, she feels the basis of feminism is something that has to do with liberating men and women from prescribed roles. Did she at any point give you an interview, Michael?
She did not.
Okay. How do you approach that when you're researching a book? I mean, there are so many, I'm sure, people out there who want to give you a story. How do you decide what to put in, what to leave out? How do you validate the stories?
Well, I will say, first of all, that she did me a great favor of kind of leaving me to my own devices. You know, she knew about the book, and she could have easily made it very difficult to do my research, but as far as I could tell, she didn't try to interfere. And I talked to over 80 people, you know, friends, classmates, teachers, co-stars, directors, a couple ex-boyfriends even, and I had a great time talking. It was like a big scavenger hunt, trying to piece together this story of her life in the 70s. And, you know, certainly there were some people along the way who, you know, if they said something, I would really want to bounce it off other people to make sure that, you know, two people had the same memory. I mean, we are talking about things that were 40 years ago. So I was very careful and very conscientious about, you know, not just believing everything I heard, but you know, really getting to know communities of people who she was part of.
Right, right. My guest is Michael Shulman. His new book is Her Again, Becoming Meryl Streep. What of what of all your research surprised you the most about Meryl Streep?
Well, one thing that was a real surprise, and a real happy surprise, was that I happened to come across this guy named Mike Booth, who was her her high school sweetheart. They went to the prom together in Bernardsville in New Jersey when she was growing up. And he had an incredible story to tell. After high school, they broke up. He went to Vietnam and enlisted as a medic in a military hospital, and she went to Vassar. And they corresponded the entire time, so between Vassar and Vietnam. And she would tell him all about this intellectual awakening she was having. You know, she was reading James Joyce and studying Italian and acting in Strindberg plays, and he was stuck halfway across the world in Vietnam. And then when he came back, he had this sort of classic a veteran story of trying to fit in his old life and not really being able to. He tried to start things up with Meryl again, and they couldn't quite connect anymore. And I found that to be such a epic romantic tale. But also, what was really amazing about it to me was that just a few years later, she starred in The Deer Hunter, which is about that. You know, it's a mm-hmm. Vietnam War movie, and she's that girl back home that, you know, Christopher Walken and Robert De Niro are pining for. So I had no idea that she had ever been a part of a relationship like that. So that was a real revelation to me.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, when John Cazale died, and I mean, he was this major love of her life, no doubt, reading the book. She married 6 months later when she met a sculptor, and she's still married to him today. Tell us about that story.
This was another major reason why I wanted to focus on that part of her life, just because of this incredible 6 month period where John Cazale died in March, she married Don Gummer in September, and you know, it was so intriguing to me. You know, it almost reminds me of a Meryl Streep movie where she's torn between these two extreme emotions, you know, grief on the one hand and infatuation on the other. And at the same time, she, during those 6 months, she started filming Kramer versus Kramer and Manhattan, and she was starring in The Taming of the Shrew and Shakespeare in the Park. So it was an incredibly fertile creative time for her as well. You know, this was the work that would really catapult her into stardom, happening at the very same time as this very conflicted personal saga she was going through.
Yeah, it was interesting because I read somewhere that you said the story of her rise is also the story of the men who tried to mold her, love her, or put her on a pedestal. I think we've kind of touched on all three of those in our conversation here. It's not easy to sustain any career today because things change so rapidly, and staying relevant is key to success. But in Hollywood, where everything's geared to the young and the fabulous and the latest craze, why do you think she's had such a long and successful career? What in her character do you think has contributed to her longevity?
Well, I think of her as a character actress who's trapped in a leading lady's body. You know, she has this incredible, unique beauty that allowed movie producers to make her the star of these Hollywood epics like Sophie's Choice and Out of Africa and these sort of huge movies she made in the 80s. But she always felt inside like she wanted to play everyone. She didn't want to be an ingenue. She didn't want to play these sort of archetypal female roles. And she never sort of traded on any sort of sex appeal or anything like that. And I think a lot of actresses, they grow out of that phase, at least in the eyes of the movie industry, whereas Meryl Streep has such incredible range, and not only that, but the desire to play different genres and experiment, that's a much more enduring kind of career. And I think especially in the past 10 years, we've seen her do this amazing work in movies like Julie and Julia and The Devil Wears Prada and The Iron Lady and even Mamma Mia. I feel like she's just sort of loosened up and is exploring things that she may not have earlier in her career. So I think she feels really liberated, and she's doing things that she loves, that she finds fun. And that's always fun to watch.
Yes, I am a huge fan of her. I've seen all of her work. Do you have a favorite movie yourself of Meryl Streep's?
So mine is a tie. It's between Kramer versus Kramer and The Devil Wears Prada.
Oh.
And I would argue that there's a similarity because in both cases, she played someone who originally was written as the villain, but she kind of made them the secret hero.
And that takes talent. And she's a very talented actress. One of my favorites, for sure. I think one of my favorite movies of hers was Falling in Love with Robert De Niro. It's quite a little known movie, but I love that movie for some reason. And that, my guest was Michael Shulman, contributed to The New Yorker since 2006. And the book, again, is called Her Again, Becoming Meryl Streep. All right, we're going to take a very quick break. When I come back, we'll be joined by Peter Brown Hoffmeister and his new book called This Is the Part Where You Laugh. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please do stay with us.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Coming up September 11th on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Love artist and activist Scott Seibel, whose latest book, Big Love, is making waves. And New York Times bestselling author Neil Pasricha, who delivered one of TED Talk's most listened to presentations. He's the director of the Institute of Global Happiness, and his new book, 2 Minute Mornings, could be the life changer you need. Tune in every Monday at noon, Fridays at 6 a.m. Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to animal communicator, intuitive, medium, and Reiki master Darcy Pariso, we cover the world of animals. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Talk radio with a purpose. Alternative Talk, 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And I was reading some information on my next guest, and according to the one sheet I have, he was expelled from 3 high schools. He was homeless for part of his sophomore and senior year, even living in a Greyhound bus station for a short while. And his new novel is called This Is the Part Where You Laugh, which sings a similar song. So we'll learn how much of this is Peter's story and how much of this is total fiction. Let me tell you a little bit more about Peter Brown Hoffmeister. He's a high school creative writing teacher and co-founder of the Integrated Outdoor Program, which takes teens of all backgrounds into wilderness areas to backpack, climb, spelunk, orient, and whitewater raft. And we've had him on the show before, so we're very pleased to welcome him back again with this new book. It's called This Is the Part Where You Laugh. Peter Brown Hoffmeister, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me again.
It's my pleasure. And so I want to talk a little bit about, because you've written memoir before about the boys. You've written graphic novel about Yosemite Valley. That's kind of what we talked about last time. This is pure fiction, is that correct?
Yeah, this is a novel.
And so since you had a different kind of upbringing, by the sound of it, how much of you has gone into the main character in this book, if any?
Well, I mean, my early childhood is very different from the main character in the new novel, this is the part where you laugh, because Travis grew up with a heroin-addicted mother living in and out of weekly motels and then being homeless on the street. And my early childhood was wonderful. I was homeschooled by my mother, who was very much not a drug addict. She's an oil painter, and she lives in Tucson. And we were homeschooled in Tucson when I was young, and that's where I really started the homeschooling. And then I was homeschooled for 7 years before high school. So my early childhood was wonderful. We traveled. We were in the outdoors a lot. We explored. And my dad was there. The father figure isn't here in the novel. So really, it's not similar as far as early childhood goes. But then in his teenage years, when he's making mistakes and getting arrested, I definitely did a little or a lot of that.
Right, right. So let's just talk a little bit about, what's happened to you since we last talked? Because it's been a while, but you're up here in the Northwest. As you said, you have this passion for the outdoors. You're still teaching, right?
I'm actually on leave right now. I'm not teaching right now, but I'm going to go back in the fall.
Mm-hmm. And what is it about teaching that drives you?
Well, I love being with young people. I just love being with teenagers. I think that's such a vibrant, interesting community, and I love the teen sense of humor, the sarcastic way of looking at the world. I love the passion in my high school community, and you know, I've taught some classes at the university, and I've taught some classes in grade schools, and I would say that just being around teenagers is so wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that kind of drives me. But then also I love reading and writing. I love books. I love teaching creative writing too.
Yeah. And so is that what, is your love of teenagers what, you know, makes you, because you're writing young adult literature here. Now, I want you to correct this because I know this is not true. There's a myth out there I've heard many people say, oh, it's easier to write young adult literature. It's not. So you put your 10 cents worth in on that.
Well, I mean, a young adult is more of a marketing distinction in my experience, because I wrote an adult literary memoir, and then I wrote an adult literary novel, and then I wrote a young adult novel, and I wrote all three using the same process.
Right.
So for me, it had more to do with the age of the narrator and with the coming of age issues. And that's why my agent sold it as young adult, because my narrator is 16 and his friends are 16 and 17. The girl he's with, Natalie, and his best friend, an older boy named Creature, are all in high school. So with that age characters and with coming of age issues and with no parents involved, it's a natural fit for young adult. But as far as writing it goes, I just followed the same process I follow on each novel. So I didn't change anything.
Right, right. Well, David Arnold, who's the author of Mosquito Land, said your book is so real it hurts. Hoffmeister explores the depths of family and addiction, friendship and first love. This story will stick with you. Let's just take a little bit, a look at the overarching story here. The summer takes a dark turn when Creature, one of the characters here, is attacked by a gang member. But tell us a little bit about the story, if you will.
Well, in a way, it's a romance between Natalie and Travis, and then Creature and his Russian princesses in his mind.
Who he writes about. He writes about them.
Right. But really, the story started back with a short story. Travis was getting picked up each day for school by an older basketball teammate, and they would go to school, and Travis's mother in the original short story, but now grandmother, was dying, and he wasn't talking about it, and his friend would spend the whole ride to school talking about these erotic love letters that he wrote to Russian princesses. And so the book started with that short story, and then I realized that there was a bigger story there, and I moved it to a real place in Eugene, Oregon, on a real lake where there's a trailer park on one side and $500,000 homes with rolling lawns on the other side, and so I wanted this bigger story about him dealing with his grandmother's death, and then I started kind of putting together the pieces and realizing that he was in love with this girl together a little bit because basketball in Eugene, as far as street ball, is played under the bridge, but that's also where the heroin addict sleeps. So it kind of started to come together that way.
You begin the book with a story that it sent chills down me for personal reasons. Where Travis is releasing two alligators into the lake because he thinks it will cheer things up. And I was kayaking here on Lake Washington many years ago now, and they had just drained a very small lake, probably more like a pond. They had just drained a pond in Washington State because somebody had put said they'd seen an alligator in there. I don't know if they ever found one or not, right? But I was kayaking one night by myself down Mercer Slough, and I had this story on my mind, and I saw this log with two eyes, and I'm like instantly panicked because I thought it was an alligator, and then one of the eyes got up and moved. It was two turtles on a log.
Oh, my God.
But though I seriously had a moment of sheer panic where I just remember telling myself, stay calm, stay calm, stay calm.
It's not going to eat my kayak. Yeah, I set the book in my great Annie Ruth's house. She died in that trailer park in Eugene. And she and my wife and I would play poker every Friday night. And she was 92 and on an oxygen tank. And so we would joke that we would pretend that we were drinking because she loves hot toddies. And we would drink hot toddies, pretend hot toddies. And we would smoke because she wasn't allowed to smoke anymore. And we would play poker and she would take all of our money. And I always said that I was going to release alligators or crocodiles or caimans or something on the lake. And then all of the elderly people in this trailer park would have something to talk about. And I never did it, and she passed away. And so I decided to have my character do it.
There we go. There's the crossover between reality and fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you can't do it in real life, do it in fiction.
That's right. That's right. Well, when we come back, I want to talk to you a little bit about the writing process, because we didn't talk about your writing process last time we talked, and I'm always interested in that, and I know our listeners are too. My guest is Peter Brown Hoffmeister. His new book is a novel. It's called This is the Part Where You Laugh. Try Until You Fail, Cry Until You Laugh. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. We'll be right back.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicky St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicky partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services, if you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicky today. Email Vicky at VickySt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicky and her work at VickySt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair airs live every Monday at noon. And now you can also catch the show during drive time at 6 a.m. every Friday. Hear from New York Times bestselling authors, innovative business leaders, cutting-edge health and wellness professionals, award-winning journalists, filmmakers, explorers, and adventurers. Tune in to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Mondays at noon Pacific time and Fridays at 6 a.m. right here on Alternative Talk 1150. Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Working hard to put a smile on your face. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Peter Brown Hoffmeister. He's a Northwest writer. He's in the Oregon area. And his new book is called This is the Part Where You Laugh. This is a novel sold as young literature, but certainly a book that I think a lot of adults would read, too. Peter, I want to talk a little bit about writing process with you. And what that's like for you, because I know you said you've taken a leave of absence, but normally you're working and raising a family. How do you juggle all of that and still get time for your writing?
That's a good question. It's a little bit difficult, but I try to write every single day. So I get up early in the morning, and I try to get up in the dark and just make coffee and prepare my brain for a few minutes and then start writing and just write every day, and there's really no magic to it. It's just doing it every single morning, no matter what. That's kind of my general process when I'm teaching.
Right. And so
then when I'm not teaching, I actually have more time to write. I've taken a few leaves over the last few years. I'm on leave right now. And so I'll get up early in the morning and I'll work on my next novel. But then later in the day, I'll come back and I'll work on revisions on something else, like on an essay or a short story or on the next novel that's going to publish, something like that.
Right. And so do you give yourself a word count per day or a set number of hours per day, or do you just want to, you know, attack a couple of scenes per day? How do you normally approach that?
Actually, that's funny that you asked that, because I go in and out of word counts. When I'm writing a rough draft, I do try to maintain a word count. For example, with This is the Part Where You Laugh, I wrote most of the draft while we were living in a small village in Costa Rica a couple years ago. And I had about 40,000 words to go to have basically a rough draft to be around 70,000 words. And so I decided for 40 days straight I was going to write 1,000 words a day. And I was just going to hit that every day. And when I got to 1,000 words, I was going to stop. And I was either going to, if I had more time, go back and revise. If I didn't have time, I'd just leave it and start over the next day. And so for 40 days, I wrote 40,000 words. And that really was good for me because it was just something so concrete. I couldn't, you know, deceive myself or anything like that.
Right.
But then there are other times where, you know, I'm really busy with revising a novel and there's no way to do that and actually have a word count or anything. But I will sometimes say, okay, I'm working on a revision of this novel, so I'm going to revise 10 pages per day. And I'm just going to work on these 10 pages. So if the novel's 330 pages long, then I'm going to revise it for 33 days. And then I'm going to be through that draft, and then I can go back to the beginning. And then no skipping forward, no going back. Sometimes it's just good to have rules like that so mm-hmm. that I'm not, you know, drifting in this open ocean and trying to figure out what I should be doing each day. It's just daily work, just like I'm punching a time clock, except I like it a lot more.
Right. Now, do you begin with an outline? Do you outline your characters, your storyline, your plot, or is this more of an organic kind of free flow for you?
both, but I start with organic free flow. I write 200 or 300 pages almost aimlessly, but maybe keeping a word count every single day. But I'll get 200 or 300 pages in, and then I'll spend a few days, usually camping or something, just thinking about the novel.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll go back and I'll start writing notes and an outline, because then I'll have something to work with. And so that's when I'll take big chunks, blocks, scenes, and I'll move them around and organize them thematically, and rather than chronologically, so that they make more sense as a story arc. So right. I'll say, okay, thematically, what fits together? And so I'll start to organize my notes based on that, based on scene. And then I start to put things in order that way. And then I have a somewhat ordered 200 or 300 pages, but I'll realize, of course, as you know, that I need to cut about half of that, because mm-hmm. half the scenes really won't work once I figure out a bigger arc. And so then I go back and I start writing fill-in scenes, like scenes that need to happen, flashbacks, that kind of stuff. And then once I've got a solid draft of 300 or 400 pages, then I'll go back and revise and do maybe 2 or 3 or 4 revisions. And then on about draft 6, I'll have somewhat of an okay book, and I'll start giving it to readers like my agent.
Right, right. So let's talk about dialogue, because I have put down so many books because the dialogue is written so poorly. It just grates on my nerves and I can't get past it. Your dialogue is very, very smooth. I mean, you don't even differentiate between story and dialogue, really. It blends so well. So let's talk about how you accomplish that, Peter, because it's not an easy thing. You know, people think dialogue is easy, but to do it well, it's not.
No, it's really difficult. The first 50 stories or so that I wrote in college, and it's funny going back to those, there's almost no dialogue because I was so scared of writing dialogue and writing it poorly. But I think what really helped me is that I talk out loud as my characters,
mm-hmm.
and so my characters become closer to me than my friends. And so, you know, I'll go outside and, like a crazy person, stand in the backyard and stand, like, stare off and start talking as one of the characters.
Right, right.
But I also steal. I mean, I'm stealing all the time. I have a high school daughter, and so I steal lines from her and her friends all the time. I steal, you know, half sentences from my students. I'm always listening to people in coffee shops. If I'm on a bus, if I'm on a plane, I mean, I'm always writing down things that people say. Because the way real people talk is really strange, you know, with their half sentences and their lingo that they keep coming back to you and all that kind of stuff.
And the hand signals, so much of it is verbal.
Oh, yeah, nonverbal.
Visual, yeah, nonverbal.
That might be one of the most difficult things, because I've noticed that so many people, when they speak, nod. And so I find myself wanting to write, you know, he nods, whatever. But you can't write that 15
right.
times a page. It would drive your reader crazy. So it's almost like it's real, but hyper real.
Right, right. And let's talk about eavesdropping, because
yeah.
One of the pieces I sold most years and years and years and years ago was a very simple post I did on eavesdropping. Because as a child, you know, I was talking in the break, and my grandmother was, you know, born in 1890, so she very definitely had Victorian manners. And she would always tell me, stop listening, because I would listen to people's conversations, even as a small child. And she goes, it's rude to, you know, to listen over like that. But I wrote this post on eavesdropping, because as a writer, you can't help but do it. It doesn't matter how intense I am on my work. There's a little piece of one of my ears that's still listening out for those, you know, those zingers, those one-liners. Tell us how that works for you.
Well, I mean, first, the greatest 19th century novelist, Jane Austen, was the best eavesdropper of all time. So I mean, she was writing in a crowded room lots of times. So I think it's so important to eavesdrop. I think if you're not listening, then you really can't write dialogue. It's just not possible.
Right, right.
And I think writers generally, from the writers I've met, David Arnold, and I was so grateful for his blurb because I loved his novel Mosquito Land and his character Mim. But, you know, I know he's always listening. I know writers that I admire so much, Toni Morrison, she talks about listening to storytellers and understanding their voice, all that kind of stuff.
Right, right.
I think if you're not listening, you're not really preparing to write. So if you're a listener and you're really curious about other people, I think those are two good things for becoming a better writer.
Right. Well, one of the things we also need is a certain amount of discipline, and we only have a minute or so left here, Peter, but what does discipline mean to you in your world of creativity? Because people often think discipline and creativity don't go together, but they have to when you're doing something like this.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't believe in a muse. I think you just sit down every morning or sit down every night, just have a same time every single day and do, even if it's only I can write 15 minutes every single day, it's every single day so that you have that habit, that practice. I like to think of writing as almost like a physical pursuit, even though it's a creative pursuit. But if you do it every day, if you are disciplined, then you allow your mind to be more creative because you're not stressed about the doing or the not doing. That decision's already made.
Right. And this book is called This Is the Part Where You Laugh. What number book is this? 5, 6?
This is 4. Number 5 is coming out next year.
Okay, number 5 is coming out next year. Well, we look forward to that, Peter.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. And we're glad to have had you on the show again. And say hi to Dylan, your dog. We both have a dog named Dylan. We talked about that in the break today, but. And I really appreciate you being with us today. Final quick thought you'd like to leave listeners with?
I'm just grateful for any reader, so thank you so much.
All right. Well, you can find out more about Peter and his work at peterbrownhoffmeister.com, peterbrownhoffmeister.com. And he's also on Facebook. One of the things I love about Peter is he shares his successes and his not-so-hot moments. And I think we all can learn a lot from that. I know I certainly learn a lot from my not-so-hot moments. So check him out, peterbrownhoffmeister.com, and his book again, This Is the Part Where You Laugh. And I want to thank each of you for joining us today. I appreciate you spending this hour with us. If you have any questions on today's show, you can find me at info@conversationslive.net. Or at the 800 number, which is 495-7617, 800-495-7617. I'm also on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair, which is V-I-C-K-I-S-T-C-L-A-I-R, and on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. So thanks for being with us. I appreciate, as I said, spending this hour with us, and we'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Coming up September 11th on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, love artist and activist Scott Seibel, whose latest book, Big Love, is making waves, and New York Times bestselling author Neil Pasricha, who delivered one of TED Talk's most listened to presentations. He's the director of the Institute of Global Happiness, and his new book, 2-Minute Mornings, could be the life changer you need. Tune in every Monday at noon, Fridays at 6 a.m. Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair airs live every Monday at noon. And now you can also catch the show during drive time at 6 a.m. every Friday. Hear from New York Times bestselling authors, innovative business leaders, cutting-edge health and wellness professionals, award-winning journalists, filmmakers, explorers, and adventurers. Tune in to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair Mondays at noon Pacific time and Fridays at 6 a.m. right here on Alternative Talk 1150.